Now, today's guest on In the Arena is Cody Royal. Cody is one of those people that I naturally found myself drawn to in life. Firstly, just by coming across his podcast, Where Others Won't, which was also the title of his first book. And finding, and we have this conversation about it, someone who's prepared to put their thinking and insights and ideas into the world on the basis that it can stack up against whatever the world is also producing, and the courage that actually requires. And the interesting thing we talked about as part of that is just the ideas around competitiveness. And you know, I often think now of competitiveness as bringing out these more unhealthy parts of ourselves. But he saw it as more this idea of the quality of the work and my thinking needs to be able to stack up. So therefore, the work I do in order for it to stack up must be there. And it's no surprise he talks about his mother, and her story is powerful. She was orphaned at 16 and, you know, forced to take on her father's mortgage and raise a couple of kids, and at the same time as a single mother, you know, built a great career. And that experience for Cody was very informative in terms of the resilience and the going deep aspect to his own life. He's come to coaching almost from the disappointment of the playing career, which didn't quite work out. And he played in all the elite programs coming through the system as a young fella in Australia, and then saw many of the players who he played with and against go through and have, you know, outstanding careers at the highest level. And in many ways that informed, you know, the next phase of his career, which was as a coach himself and in an unusual coaching environment, in that he took his coaching to Canada, which I believe, and ended up coaching the Canadian team in International Rules Series, which is a unique form of coaching, because he's often coaching athletes who have never or have no history in the game itself, and a true test of coaching from that perspective. But for me, and from a distance, where I think he's done his best work is the coaching of coaches, the coaching of leaders. And these have been expressed through his books, Where Others Won't, The Tough Stuff, and A Second Set of Eyes, and I highly recommend them. And he talks about the weight of leadership. And the interesting part of today's conversation is just the simple idea of coaches and leaders who see the value of coaching and leading as an expression of who they are, but don't get the support they actually need to be the best they can be at it. And it's almost the irony of our own expertise in regard to this. He's a wonderful fella. It's a great conversation. Really proud to call him as a friend, and I think you'll enjoy this a lot. So In the Arena with Cody Royal. Okay, I'm here with Cody Royal, and I hate to tell you, Cody, but you're the reason. The fact that you're there is the reason that I'm here as well, as in the influence of you as someone who's been prepared to put your word out to the world has been wonderful inspiration for me. And as you probably found in setting up your own podcast, which was certainly one of my go-to podcasts for a long period of time, that you actually learn a whole lot about people by doing the podcast themselves, even if you thought that you actually knew them. And when your note came through today, just in regard to your background, the first thing which struck me was the role your mother's played. And the word which came to mind was resilience. So she's got a wonderful story, hasn't she?
She has. And yeah, thanks, Cam, for having me. I think, you were the only person that was on my show twice. So I think that shows what I think of you and your work. So happy to join you here. And I'm sure that came across through my mother and her story and kind of what she's been able to teach both me and my sister about, you know, how to go out into the world. You know, even being able to move literally halfway across the world, you know, as a 25-year-old, you know, your role as a parent is to prepare your kids to go out into the world and have functional skills and being able to navigate. And yeah, I moved halfway across the world with just a couple of suitcases and made things work. And so that's all of the things that she taught me. But yeah, she has a remarkable story. She was orphaned at 16. Both of her parents passed away of cancer after the UK government were testing nuclear weapons in the Australian outback. And so, you know, no parents at 16, doesn't finish school, has to take on a mortgage for the house, which was illegal at the time. 16-year-old couldn't have a mortgage.
Yeah, no, imagine, yeah.
And then kind of has to, go about life with, you know, no parents and very little guidance, and ends up, you know, she raises two kids as a single mother and, you know, becomes a top salesperson at Kraft Foods, which was one of the big, you know, food service companies at the time. And so, yeah, it's resilience and hard work and, but really, you know, those functional skills and just learning by doing. I hope that I can carry that on and then also pass that on to my kids as well, because they're such profound lessons for all of us.
Did you understand that at the time? Or is that, you're someone who's very reflective, you know, and we'll talk about your books as we go through, but someone who has, you know, taken the time to think through, you know, the lessons learned, how obvious were they to you at the time?
Look, I was a young man, so probably not very. I'd say a lot of that has really come to light probably since moving here at 25. You realize that you do have all these skills, and then you kind of turn 30 and you start to reflect again on your early life and you become a parent, and then more makes sense. And so it's certainly been unfolding over time, but that's one of the reasons that I wanted to start creating things and documenting things, was it's a snapshot into who you are at that time. And I really like that idea that you can kind of, either through my books or my podcast or blogs or anything, you can see who 30-year-old Cody is. And you can see how he changes by 35, and he reflects more and learns new things. And it's one of the things I love about content, but specifically books. So I think you can probably see that in my writing as well, that it starts to probably reflect on a lot of those lessons and core elements of those lessons, you know, as I get older.
It's interesting, because I'm reading a Pat Cummings book where he's interviewing a number of leaders at the moment, and I've only just started it, and it's called Tested, which is great. It's a great name for a book, but it talks about him, you know, taking on, and majority of people who come into leadership roles are coming in for a reason. They aren't coming in because it's been designed that way. It's normally through some circumstance which has happened. And his was, you know, Australian cricket captain. You've had the sandpaper gate thing. Then you've had the Tim Payne issue. And he basically got asked to present his credentials for the role itself, which he'd been vice captain, but he hadn't really thought about it because he was a bowler and that doesn't normally happen. And, you know, Australian cricket mm-hmm. captains aren't bowlers, that type of thing. And it wasn't until he actually put the presentation together that the whole concepts and ideas around leadership and just how important it was for him. But going back to your thought, just how much he'd grown from the 18-year-old who made his test debut to now the 28-year-old who's going to be, yeah, potentially captaining Australia. And just as he started, it wasn't till the fingers were on the keyboard or the PowerPoint presentation, however he was going to present, was actually being formed, did he actually realise just how much growth he'd had and just how profound even some of the parenting influences. And he talks a lot about his mother who sadly passed away from cancer. So that idea of the sense-making element doesn't really strike you until such time as you actually, yeah, the fingers do hit the keyboard, or the pen hits the notebook in some ways. But that seems to me something which you've had an appetite for, you know, pretty early in your life. Does that come from anywhere in particular, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's actually those two parts of me meshed together. If I, again, look at it retrospectively, like English was my best subject at school. I think I was quite a decent writer, but the only thing you could do with that was go into journalism. And yes, I didn't really want to do that. But by getting into coaching early, you know, I was 23 when I started coaching, to then kind of arrive in my mid-20s and need a way to get out of my head and to diarize things and to write things down and have them crystallize. And so that, yeah, I kind of had both of those skills. And by pairing them together, then to your point, a lot of clarity transpires. And so, you know, in doing what I'm doing now, I would say that's one of the things that strikes me that a lot of leaders don't do. They don't. You can ask a lot of coaches and they haven't written down their philosophy of leadership. And, you know, so it might be in their heads, but they haven't been able to put it down and play around with it and realize what works and doesn't work, or what comes from their mother or their father, or, you know, and so the process of writing actually helps a lot of things crystallize and creates a lot of clarity. And so, yeah, I was lucky. I was keen to do it. I was keen to put it out there. Started a blog at like 28 or something, which was really just an immature rant on all the things that I disagreed with in leadership. But it really started to turn into, philosophical ideas, clarity, and really being able to challenge myself, a way of journaling, I guess.
Were you journaling out loud in some ways?
In all ways.
Yeah. So you're prepared to take your, at least a lot of your inner thoughts, and put them out to the world. And I'm sure the world gave you feedback from time to time as well, you know, in that sense. And so there's courage embedded in that as well.
The environment also contributed to that, Cam. Like I would say by being an Aussie rules coach away from Australia, you know, my story is, played TSC Cup and didn't get drafted, and, you know, was a frustrated mid-20s kind of kid, like a lot of kids that miss out on their dream. And by moving away, it kind of created a little bit of that element, in that if I had have been having opinions on coaching footy in Australia, the response would have been much more drastic. It would have been, shut up, you didn't make it, so who are you to tell anyone anything about footy or leadership? In North America, that doesn't exist. Some of the most heralded people over here are high school coaches that everyone is trying to get their time, try to get their opinions. And really just the act of being a coach and knowing that you've got a shared experience and that you've led is enough. And so I would say that also contributed to my probably desire to put ideas out and share them, and sure, cop criticism, but it felt, you know, a little less impact, perhaps, maybe on my ego more than anything. But it also allowed people to grab onto them and build on top of them and do new things with them, which I really enjoyed as well.
Yeah, well, that was certainly what it did for me, that I could see part of what I was trying to say and what you'd already said. And then you were able to add your own, you know, flavour to it, your own layers to it. And it was also introducing me to people who perhaps had an influence over you who I wouldn't have otherwise accessed. I think there was probably an element of that as well. So it seems that it was almost... there was a sense of safety in it, in a way that perhaps you might have felt. Yeah, you're doing it from, was Toronto, I think, at the time, was it? Is that where you're basically working it from? So you might have done that from Glen Waverley, but you're prepared to do it from Toronto. You know? So it seems a bit weird, doesn't it, really? Like, you, we think of home as being the safe place, you know, that's your first thought. And whereas actually, you know, part of the, even perhaps even the lack of knowledge and understanding and insights in regard to how, you know, football works in Australia versus how it works in other places, and, you know, the sense of not making it, and which I'd really like to explore with you, because that's really your arc into coaching, isn't it? That idea. So being however many thousands of kilometres away from home was actually a safe place for you.
Yeah, and, you know, again, to bolt on to that safe idea, you know, there was inclusion was part of that. And I ended up being the national team coach for the men's team here in Canada, which most people don't know was a thing. But by virtue of that, I went to the conferences with the soccer coach and the, you know, the ice hockey coaches. And so, you know, I was included in things that, again, I wouldn't have been included in if I'd stayed at home. And that also creates a kind of a rich, you know, tapestry of ideas and networking and a place to play with other coaches in other team invasion sports and bounce ideas off, that, again, probably contributed to that desire to keep putting ideas and sharing ideas, because I knew our sport could help a lot of the sports here, but also, yeah, it was going to be welcomed. I felt it was going to be welcomed. So, again, there's an environmental element to it, which I am thankful for.
It's interesting, because I immediately sort of reflected on, you know, because my father and my parents were, my family were very embedded in the sport, and we had well-known, you know, football people around me all the time growing up. And I worked out as a young fella, if you're really quiet when you're 10 years of age, you can pretty much get in anywhere, I reckon. You know, you can, there's almost, I literally would sit in post-game match committee meetings where, you know, the coaches and the match committee were delisting players at the Richmond Footy Club, you know. And
wow.
And I just pretended. And I was just sort of almost, you know, hiding under the wing of my dad, you know, knowing that, you know, at that night he'd probably just drop me off home and then he'd be off to tell some poor poor young player that he's not, you know, it's time to clean out your locker, you know, just even. And so probably gave you experiences which in some cases a young fella shouldn't experience, but in other ways made everything else almost accessible. You know, you're in conversation with people and they're quite early days treating you almost as though you're a peer, whereas you might be looking around and saying, well, these guys are at a different level to what I'm at. And but then by being in conversation with them in the way that you were, you found, oh, hang on, I can contribute to this. I'm keeping up with this. I've actually got something to bring to this. Gee, that would be interesting in our sport. There's a curiosity which you're bringing, which is then opening up you to whatever experiences the environment is providing for you in those times. And the thing I really strikes me about your work is the courage and empathy which is embedded in it. And I think a bit about, say, that arc from the nearly player. So it sounds like you were a nearly player coming through the system. So you were in squads, but didn't get quite selected. You saw players who are your peers go through and play and do the thing that you were aspiring to do. And it sounds like initially that was met with some bitterness may have overwhelmed at different times. Would that be fair?
Yeah, definitely. I remember one specific example. I spent a year at Port Melbourne and, you know, cold, middle of the season kind of training session. And I got completely overwhelmed and just stopped in the middle of a training session. And I was about to walk off the field, literally get in my car and go home. So I'm done with this. Like it just, yeah, you know, I certainly at, you know, 19 years old and immature and kind of not wanting to do anything at university and not being able to grapple with, you know, what I felt had happened to me and, you know, not being able to realize my dream, but knowing my friends were doing it was a little tough to take as at that age. And so, I went through the full emotional ringer. And again, I told you the story about, I'm kind of glad that happened in a way because it introduced me to coaching, which was the thing that managed to recapture my imagination and my passion for the sport. And it came back, you know, in spades.
Were there people who saw something in you at that time that you perhaps hadn't seen in yourself who may have encouraged you down that track?
There were, yeah. Actually, I can remember, speaking of Richmond, the person that came to me on that night, and it was actually quite a profound moment just in my journey in general, was David Burke. He was the only one that came over to me that day at Port Melbourne.
Yeah. Just for reference, for those who, David Burke is the son of Francis Burke, who's the son of Frank Burke. So he was a third generation Tiger, and Francis Burke, he's probably the most revered name in the history of the Richmond Football Club. And so poor old David, who was a terrific player, has had to live in the shadow of not just only a great player, but just this revered figure as well in that sense. And he was a far more, he almost had a larrikin element to him too, David, didn't he? He had a much, Francis was pretty, you know, straight up and down. So David, who had a lot of injuries, sadly, didn't have the career that perhaps he would have dreamt of having as well, because he was a very gifted player. He's post his AFL career at this point, and he's taken a young Cody aside, has he? Is that what's happened?
Well, that no, he was at North at the time, so we were had the new agreement with North, and so yeah, it was just must have been a Thursday night training session with the AFL boys there, and yeah, just kind of saw this young kid struggling and came over and said, well, let's chat. So that was one, and I've never forgotten that. And it's kind of stood out to me when I'm watching, you know, my own players play and struggle and go through the emotions of being young. And yeah, it's really stood out to me. But then, yeah, from a coaching perspective, certainly, again, I had a lot of people come to me and say, you know, you can do this. You know, like a lot of people kind of get a tap on the shoulder and they're not really thinking about being a coach. And then someone says, hey, you know, you think about this in an interesting way. Would you ever consider it? And so Graham Bergen was that person for me, who he ended up director of coaching at Calder Cannons and got me down there and really showed me what, you know, that kind of elite level pathway coaching was about. Started my journey. And as soon as I saw that, you know, I got to work with, you know, three first round draft picks in my first under 15 class. Like I was like, oh,
yeah, so you had a good
I love
group.
This.
Yeah. 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 So it sounds like the lark into coaching was also probably just just scratched away or took away any sort of negativity you might have had about the game, you know, from your playing perspective. But it would also seem that that playing experience was very informative in terms of your coaching as well. Yeah, would that be fair?
Yeah, I was an overthinker. So again, maybe that was one of the qualities that a coach sees in a player and thinks that's actually a benefit in what we do. And so I certainly think that was part of what allowed me to be okay at coaching. It was the level of detail that I could already see whilst playing the game. Whilst I couldn't probably extract myself from that and get into a flow, like I kind of ran to places I thought the ball should go rather than running to where the ball was going. And so when I say overthinker, I mean overthinker.
Yeah.
But being able to know those cues and know those patterns and things when you're playing certainly does allow you to be able to look at what we do in coaching and go, I understand this and I think I can teach it. Yeah, I'm glad I was put into that kind of environment. Calder just pumps out amazing coaches at all levels, and there's systems there, and Ian Kite had been there forever and he knew me from the Vic Metro programs. And so I was lucky to walk into a club that even knew how to teach young coaches that were only in their mid-20s and only a couple of years removed from TAC Cup in the first place, how to then go and coach again. And so, yeah, I took everything that I learned there and kind of ran with it.
Did you learn anything about environments at that point? Like you said, the Calder is an area or a club which produces coaches. I can't imagine that's just luck.
It was vastly different to anything that I had seen from, you know, or just being around the game in terms of the structure, the organization, the thought, the detail. You can see when you walk into a place like that and you've never been there, you can look for cues. It's people like the property steward and the groundsman, and they're like the level of detail and the level of care. You know you're in a good environment where there's been a lot of consideration for all the different elements of how a team needs to go out and perform. And at least when I was there, that stood out to me straight away.
Did you understand it, or did you just think this is good? Well, you're at a stage where you could actually have sort of respect for it or, you know, insight about it, or were you just pleased to be the recipient of it?
No, I'd say at that stage I was... You know, I'd done a lot of work on culture and cultures and environments and read a lot of books, and I was most appreciative of that, I'd say. It wasn't over my head and just kind of happy to be around it. I think I knew that it was manufactured in some way and it was a reason for it. And I might not have understood, you know, all the things that went into it, but I knew that it was deliberate and it had been created that way. And you could see it in the results, but then again, you could see it in the people, and they weren't just doing it to tick a box. They were doing it because they cared the way the jerseys were folded, and they cared that the socks went in the washing bag. And I think if you pay attention to the right things and you know the cues to look for, you can kind of see those elements, whether they're a checkbox, you know, and now everyone sweeps the sheds, right? And so that's kind of become a bit of a checkbox thing, but it's not authentic to those environments and it's not thought out the way that New Zealand did it. And so, again, my interpretation of it was it wasn't people just checking a box. They knew exactly why they were doing it and they cared about it.
So you understood it to be important. Did you know where it was coming from? Who was driving it?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Because it sort of leads into the next thing, because you know, soon you're going to have your hands on those levers, aren't you? At a really young age, as you mentioned. Yeah. And so just talk a little bit about that transition. You find yourself in a different country for a start, so that's which is extraordinary in itself. But yeah, so yeah, and I know you've talked about, you know, your mother's trust to you know, to support each of the decisions that you've actually taken as well, that you're now going to go and live in a different country, do your own thing, all those sorts of elements to it, you know. So just talk me through that.
Yeah, well, you know, as much as you think you know about yourself, when you pack up and have a bit of money saved up and arrive in a new country with two suitcases and nowhere to live, don't know anyone, don't have a job, and you resolve to figure out a way to make it work, you learn about yourself very quickly. And, for me, I was probably introverted, so I learned to be a bit more extroverted, to ask for things, to ask questions, ask for a job. You know, like you kind of don't really, when you're traveling, you walk in and ask for a job, but when you're at home, you would never really kind of do that. You go through the normal processes. And so it made me come out of my shell a lot more. And then, you know, again, from a footy perspective, I didn't intend on getting involved in footy. I didn't really move away to go and hang out with Aussies again. But it was the best thing that I did. It was a network, a community, and it helped me evolve my coaching. I became a better coach because when you're coaching Canadians, you know, who've haven't even really seen the sport, you know, some of which, I mean that literally, like they hadn't seen a game on TV. Maybe one of their friends had been involved and asked them to come down and try this game. You know, the way that you teach the game becomes very different from someone who's grown up and knows what a handball is. And so again, I was immediately challenged in terms of what I thought I knew about football, what I thought I knew about coaching already, young in my career. And then I was also coaching open age men. Again, it was different and people would challenge you. And so I grew up a lot between the ages of 25 and 27 by moving away and, you know, getting involved in footy and having to go and be a bit more extroverted and come out of my shell a little bit more. That period was hugely formative for me.
And it seems that the hugely formative thing, you mentioned before about your overthinking, which wouldn't be helping you if you're in that environment at that stage, because it could just be such a heavy weight, I would imagine, if you're underthinking, read. If you're overthinking, write. And you start writing at that point and start putting your experiences out to the world. How helpful for you was that in as it related to your actual coaching? You know, it's helping you probably in regard to creating a life for yourself, which that mightn't have been the intent, but it certainly, how helpful was it in regard to you, the leader, trying to create environments at that point?
Yeah, two things there. One is that element that you mentioned, the ability to crystallize things, to get clarity, to, you know, it was journaling, really. And, you know, we've come to know the science behind that as a reflective tool or a mindful practice or whatever you want to call it. Now, but you know, back in 2009 or 10 or whenever we're talking, it wasn't as common. And so yeah, I'd say that certainly accelerated my clarity around what it was that I believed at that time. And you know, I think one of the most kind of impactful things a leader can be is clear. And so, you know, by stumbling into writing about it, mostly out of frustration, but then coming out with clarity and language and refined ideas and innovative ideas was hugely impactful. But I'll tell you what it really did for me, Cam, was it made me competitive again. Yeah. And it actually keyed into the competitor in me that had been lost when I was, you know, going through all of that stuff with footy. And so, you know, it really captured my imagination about being able to get intellectual ideas down on paper, to write them in a cogent way that other people can understand. And I started becoming competitive with my writing. Can my ideas stack up against someone?
Yeah,
and interesting. That lit a bit of a fuse. And there's elements of that in all my work subsequently. There's a reason that my first podcast is with Adam Grant and Joe Dumars, is because they were two of the best people that I could think of to put my ideas up against.
Yes.
And so...
It's interesting because competitiveness, my first response was, even though I've clearly come from a very competitive environment and clearly come from very competitive aspects of it, but I can't think of many experiences that I think of where I think it brought the best out of me, if you know what I mean. And we've talked and we're both admirers of Pippa Grange and her work, you know, the winning deep, winning shallow. I often think of, you know, my hyper-competitiveness, which was probably ego really when I think about it, as playing out in the winning shallow piece. But you're saying, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this well. My stuff's going to stack up. Is that your take on it? Is that how it came up?
Yeah, more as the, you know, Pippa's idea around the winning deep, I think, is the internal version of it, right? Like the intrinsic motivation element. And that's what I'm talking about when I say competitive. I'm not competitive writing, but I'm saying I you know, these people's ideas are thought of as world leading. If I put mine up against them, I put my best work, and I really believe that that's my best work. Can it stack up? And, you know, funnily enough, you know, we're talking about the polarity of those kind of ideas. You know, I come back on personality tests as a green red. So like the competitive bit is there, so much so that I've just included it in as one of my values. I just I like competition. It's what got me into athletics and into sport, but I also have this empathetic side. And so I call that respect. So CR are my values, competitive and respectful. It's my initials. And that is the kind of red, green, which are supposed to be the polar opposites. You're not supposed to have both of them at the same time. But yeah, they keep showing up in my tests. And so I'm going to lean into that.
Yeah, it was a couple of things come to mind and I wouldn't mind exploring with you. The first one is Pete Carroll, Seattle Seahawks fame and great coach, always had compete as one of the values. In fact, I think it's his overarching trademark. And I think, you know, competition like anything ends up being a little bit relative, doesn't it? You know, if you're going to be involved in elite sport, you haven't got a competitive mindset where you just, the thing's just going to, it's going to move too fast for you. And compete, there's different forms of winning, you know, which is why I love the, you know, the Pippa stuff. That the winning deep, winning shallow. The other thing which comes to mind a little bit is if you're going to see if your stuff stacks up, you're immediately looking at some form of comparison, aren't you? You know, how does my work stack up against Adam Grant? You know, how does my work, you know, stack up against, you know, other, you know, thought leader people have got, you know, Brené Browns, whoever it might be in regard to this type of work. The danger is that, you know, there's a wonderful saying, you know, comparison's the thief of joy as well. It could take that part away from it. I've actually started, even with people I've worked with in regard to this, when they see something like that, I go, are you jealous or are you envious? I try to differentiate. It's a very slight differentiation, I think. And I think envy, if I can remember the Brad Pitt movie, I think it's still one of the seven deadly sins. I think it's up there. But you often go, well, am I envious of, you know, Cody Royal's work in the podcast he produces, which has had these remarkable guests, has deep insights. And there was a part of me which was, yeah, I'm a bit envious. And so it's not because there's a whole identity purpose piece in regard to that. There's also probably, so there's a who and a why thing going on. And then there is probably, you've also created a bit of a system for yourself to make it happen, which is, that's pretty, most people can do that in that regard. But ultimately, it all comes down to, are you prepared to put in the work? Are you prepared to do what this thing will ask of you at different times? And so if it's easy to be envious of the purpose and the identity and the system, if you like, the who, the why, the how, but are you prepared to do what in regard to this? You know, and the what is, in this case, if the pen's not hitting the paper, if the journaling's not happening, and that's, no one's watching you then, it's in the quiet time, it's probably you've got a little fella at home and another one on the way, as I understand it. Well, you know, there's probably, life's pretty squeezed at different times, but somehow you still find the time to write a book or to, you know, to find another coach to coach. And so I'll talk a little bit about the idea of envy. Are you envy of the identity purpose, but are you envious of the work? Probably not, you know. And there's a big transformation has happened in that 10 to 15 years for you, which is, it almost seems like you've taken your disappointment and found purpose within, you know, from the disappointment in a way, and made sense of the disappointment, which now plays out mostly in a coaching sense, but also in how you communicate that to the world. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's another element, and you and I have connected over Rick Rubin, but he writes about a similar idea in his book, doesn't he, around inspiration.
Pete Carroll or?
Rick Rubin, around Rick Rubin. How many albums are inspired by a competitive album? And I forget the examples, but something like the Beach Boys released this and then the Beatles kind of responded or whatever it was. It's not a rivalry.
Sergeant Pepper's was in response, yeah. Yeah.
And not, you know, not, you maybe wouldn't call them directly competitive, or I don't, maybe there was some envy there or whatever, but there was also an element of inspiration in that it brought more out of you. And that's the way that I would think about the ideas as well, is that, I mean, geez, there's no one that would put me in anything with Adam Grant. But what Adam does is like he draws so much out of me in what he produces. And that's where I think the fuel comes from. And that's where I think, again, it's maybe that intrinsic motivation. And that's been, like I said, unexpected for me. I couldn't have imagined that writing something down would spark that element of me, like a sporting kind of primal, the emotion that comes out of people with regard to sport and playing, and to have something that's similar in my life from my sporting world come out in writing has been quite bizarre, but quite compelling as well.
No, I like it a lot. I was thinking as you were speaking then, maybe if you're born in a different place, in a different time, in a different whatever, the sporting thing may have never played out in some ways. The competitiveness just would have been expressed in different ways. And it sort of comes to mind, as you know, I studied fine art when I left footy. And the very first, and my work's mostly drawing, and almost the ultimate challenge still for anyone who draws is life drawing. You know, you've got a nude model in front of you, you're standing in a particular pose, you're trying to get the weight, the size, the look, whatever it is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And it's quite an unfamiliar environment even, that you're in a group of people and there's someone naked in front of you. It's just even that sort of concept is so foreign to us all. But I'm studying my first year at the Victorian College of the Arts, and I'm like a tribal elder in this place. I'm in my 50s, and everyone else is, you know, they're 18, 19-year-olds, you know, straight out of school. And you basically got your paper board in front of you. You do your drawing, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I couldn't help but walk around the back of everyone else's drawings after the 20 minutes was up to work out who else was really good in the class. It was just, it almost was, there was almost a sense of shame as I was walking around sort of on the basis of I'm trying to connect, but I'm weighing up the competition. I literally was, you know, as to who are the really talented artists in the group. The interesting thing was 3 years later, who the most talented artists were in the group bore almost no consideration or reference to who produced the best work 3 years later. It had almost nothing to do with it. Yeah, the one who were producing the work which was the most interesting, producing the work that were most talked about, the people most likely to find, it's a very difficult career to find a career in, to be an artist. But those who have found careers weren't the people who were the ones who were the gifted ones who could capture beautifully the image in front of you. And it's a different skill. And it just came to me to mind at that stage that I saw the same things in which players make it, which players don't, which coaches make it, which coaches don't, which administrators make it, junior footy administrators don't. Yeah, it was exactly the same thing. The kids who actually made it were the ones who slept in their studios overnight. They were the ones who went and spent as much time in the library researching artists. They were the ones who spent their weekends going to galleries and exhibitions. They were the ones who never walked around without, you know, a sketchbook and pencil under their arms. So like the kids who never, you know, the players who never, you know, they never don't have a football under their arm, you know, that it was the same mindset. And so what I worked out was that competitive instinct, it's just how it plays out. It's just how, you know, and you'll notice this with your parenting, you know, with my youngest, there was no interest in sport, but I see a fiercely competitive person. Don't worry about that. And it's in game development and, yeah, competitive to be the best they can be, but also to produce work which is just such a high quality, and there's a real sense of pride in it. So it's interesting how, but I find the people who are frustrated with it are the ones who don't in fact find the expression of it. And so your expression of it, the sport's the metaphor for something else, really, in lots of ways. Is leadership the thing for you? Is that the idea which inspires you most, just the pure idea of leadership?
Yeah, the problem that I pose as I'm trying to solve is this question in my head around why can this team do this thing but this team can't? And so you would call that leadership. Like how is someone creating the conditions that allow this group to do something and this group to not be able to do that thing? And that's endlessly fascinating to me. both on a sporting level, but it's also a societal level, a cultural level, a global level, a city, you know, why can't a city get out of its own way? Like there's teams all around us. And so, yeah, from a team perspective and leading groups, I can't help but think about that all the time. But that's the thing, to answer your question, without a doubt.
So if we're talking about leadership, we're obviously talking about leaders, aren't we, in that sense? And this, the arc of your writing, you know, where others won't, into the tough stuff. And I found the tough stuff to be a tough read, to be honest, your book. And I did because I saw so much of myself in it, in that I think I spent 20 years thinking I could outwork the problem and was doing all sorts of damage, not only to myself, but probably to a few others as part of that, because it's a really selfish way of thinking. In writing that book in particular, what were your main, you know, or made almost discoveries in regard to writing it? You know, we're probably talking mostly the weight of leadership. That would be one of the terms I would use.
Yeah, it's a very personal book to me. And what you're describing really is my pain. So it comes from my own pain. We had a player take his own life about a month before COVID. And so, yeah, as a leader, as a footy coach, it's not something you ever think about that is going to happen to you, and was kind of thrust upon me, and went looking for things that could help me with that and found nothing. And so, you know, you'll maybe appreciate the art reference here. They say you create the art that you need in the world, whether that's songs or books or whatever it may be. And so for me, it came from that place of searching. And then also, you know, the pandemic hits, and I think a lot of coaches, a lot of my peers and friends and people that I knew were also really kind of looking at their own identity. We thought all the leagues were going to fold because the games weren't going to be on TV. So the money was going to stop. So, you know, everyone was, I'm going to be out of a job. What am I going to do? You know, I have to spend time with my wife, you know, like all these kind of...
people ended up in working in supermarkets. People ended up, you know, working on sites. You know, that was, yeah.
Yes. And so the more that I was exploring, you know, kind of my own pain, and you were part of this, and you always picked up my calls when I called you as someone that I needed to speak to. So thank you for that. But yeah, the more that I explored it, the more threads I found that were so common in a lot of people. And so that became really interesting to me, that there was this thing that everyone kind of agreed on, but no one wanted to talk about. And so, yeah, there's a lot of pain in the book, and I think it raised a lot of pain for a lot of people. But I think the response has been that now we can start to talk about some of these things, and we can surface them, and we can admit that they're real things, and we can maybe empathize with leaders a little bit more, particularly head coaches in sport, they're going through, and how that might impact their ability to lead. And so, yeah, it's the work that I'm most proud of for that reason, that it's the messages that I have in response to that book, either positive or negative, like it dug stuff up or it helped me. Either way, it generated something for people that was probably laying below the surface but needed to be raised.
In digging something up, it at least provides the potential of help or the possibility of help. But my sense of the book was there was almost little empathy for the fact that the work that leaders have to do in order to lead, and the weight that they then carry as part of that, receives very little empathy. And that's not in part because people go, oh, you know, that's, you've signed up for it, that's the deal, you know, you're getting well paid, you know, you're getting well looked after and all of those things, but also because mostly they're not about making themselves available to be supported or be helped, because it's seen as something that leaders shouldn't need. They you should be good enough and tough enough just to handle whatever this thing's going to throw at you. Whereas the reality of that is, if that person's struggling, we're struggling. You know, that's just so counterproductive. If that person, I always say to people, you've never led unless you've woken up in the morning, your first thought's fuck. You know, that's one of my favorite lines. And it's basically really what that's saying is, it's overestimating the pressure that you're going to put yourself under, or the things asking of you, but you're also underestimating your own capacity to deal with whatever that thing is in whatever way. And so the book, The Tough Stuff, actually almost says that we're in a high performance mindset here, but the only person who's not practicing high performance is the person who needs to perform the highest. You know, as in the person who's getting the least sleep, the least exercise, has got the worst relationships, has got the, you know, all of that stuff going on for them, is the person who in fact is the one we need to be in the best shape.
Well, the way that I position it and my line for this is leadership is an exchange of humanity, right? And so it's what are you then transferring? And if you're transferring weight onto people, that's not the idea. But it's supposed to be connective, and it's supposed to be a shared weight. And somewhere along the line, we moved it almost in totality onto the leader. Because I don't think that's the original idea. You look at a lot of, you know, traditionally collective societies, it's the exact opposite. You know, people take the weight off the leader so that they're freed to be able to connect people and transfer positive energy and be free from a lot of the things that we've put on them subsequently. And so, yeah, again, just more than anything garners a conversation. And it's funny because what's happened since that book has come out is you've started to see leaders step down because of the weight and mention it. You know, one that stood out to me was Jacinda Ardern, who's this kind of, you know, seen at least internationally as this generational female leader that's empathetic, that kind of gets it, that's good, you know, in politics, and says, I burnt out basically from doing this. And that's not a position to be able to lead my country from. And it starts to go into sport. You've got a lot of the top college coaches at the moment stepping down. You've got people burning out literally on the job. And so it's right in front of us. And that's why it needed to have a conversation around it. Was I think we all needed to understand what this weight was doing to people, and it was actually detracting from their ability to lead us. And it doesn't need to be like.
No, there's certainly some big memories flooding back, I've got to say. How much of it for you was autobiographical?
Maybe half. I think a lot of the kind of maybe we've gone a little bit too far with the identity piece. And, yeah, I mean, certainly your biggest rival is yourself, and all of those things are born out of my own reckoning with those things. And, yeah, so I'd say half. And then legitimately the other half would be from speaking to colleagues and peers about their experiences and just looking for patterns. And the book is actually, there's more out of the three books I've written, there's more on the cutting room floor from that book. It could have been maybe another three chapters or so where there were some really pretty significant patterns, but we agreed to make it seven, you know, for a reason. And it could have maybe gone a little bit deeper as well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and I reckon anyone who's listening who is in a leadership role to spend time with this, even as the most fundamental recognition that to allow yourself to go into that place is one of the things I often think about is we grow up with all those sorts of sayings, those sorts of ideas, and say, do I really believe that, or is it just something which has just been said so often that you're almost expected it to be a certain way, you know, like competing with yourself and all that stuff. Whereas if you're not in good shape, you're dishonoring the role. You're fundamentally. And there's a wonderful quote in Neil Craig, we both share, and in his podcast, when he got tired or showed tired, the CEO basically said, "How dare you? Yeah, how dare you?" Where it was almost seen as a badge of honor to spend your life in a place of exhaustion, you know. Like, we didn't employ you to be a tired coach. No one makes a good decision, you know, when they're buggered. So that's real leadership, you know, from a CEO. I wonder, because I know the CEO, I wonder perhaps he was, I don't know if he would have stood up to the same scrutiny, I've got to say, because he probably was working pretty bloody hard as well and not necessarily always at his best for that same reason, as we never are. And it feels to me, and I talk about it because I'm pretty open about it, that I got diagnosed with depression as a CEO, early 30s, and I just was so shamed by it that I just hid it for the next 25 years. You know, going in to get going to see my psychiatrist in a hoodie, you know, sitting in the toilet waiting for the phone, you know, the phone call to ring to say, look, the coast is clear, you can now come in. You know, that was because I was just so, I hated the thought or idea that someone thought that I was getting help and support for something which I needed help and support in relation to. And, you know, we talk about mentors and the importance of having wise people in your life. Well, I had the same guy I saw for 20 years, and he was one of those people. I reckon a lot of the time I was actually feeling okay. I was just using Medicare to actually have a really good conversation with a really wise person in my life. And he was.
Yeah.
He was like a sage, you know. We all need a sage from time to time, yeah. And it sort of feels as though then from the tough stuff, the second set of eyes idea almost comes through as the potential of a little bit of an antidote in some ways to the tough stuff. Am I overreading that, or did that naturally apply or naturally flow into the next piece of thinking from that perspective?
Yeah, and again, it was the reaction to the book. So, you know, I at the time of the tough stuff, I was still coaching my team. I kind of had no real intention of doing anything else. And then I would just wake up every day to these messages from leaders. And it was, you know, it wasn't just sports coaches. It was paramedics. It was military guy. You know, my DMs just lit up. And a lot just started to say, can you work with me on the things that you've written about here? And so the second set of eyes idea, but then also my work comes off the back of the tough stuff. And yeah, again, going and actually researching the power of mentorship, and there's all sorts of scientific backing for a second set of eyes, but it's also just true when you look through history that, you know, decisions and great leaders have been supported by someone that's really looking out for them. And so again, it's a connective idea. It's a shared leadership idea. And it's a little bit of a different model than maybe we're used to now, because we've kind of built this, the leader is the pinnacle idea, but we're also not too far off, you know, and it's quite common in business circles, obviously CEOs with an executive coach. And I just really wanted people to look at all the evidence that, you know, isn't my work. I'm just pointing it out to you that there's some real benefit here, and there's some real, to use your words, antidote here to what leaders are going through, and it's sitting right in front of us.
I still think there's hardly anyone getting it, having one that, like, even the CEOs, people talk about the idea of an executive coach. I would say it would be 1 in 20, not even that, 1 in 50. People who are in the hardest roles have got the most ambiguous. They're not doing the job unless they're facing into the complexity and the ambiguity of the role in the first place. When you've got no support for how you do that, and there's naturally a sense of isolation in the role itself. And so the line I like to use, yes, it's going to be lonely. There's no question it's going to be lonely, but it doesn't mean you're alone. You know, that's the thought. So even in, you know, when you were faced into, you know, like the trauma of, from a personal perspective, but as it related to being coming from a place of love and care for the teammates of your player who committed suicide, and his family, I'm sure as well, there was an expectation, and you want to try and do that on your own. So basically, you making a phone call to me might be just a 0.001% of the chance that you're not on your own, that you at least know there is someone who'll take the first phone call and would probably take any other phone call that is required from that point onwards for you. Well, often we're not, you know, I say the metaphor, you see someone walking down a set of stairs, they've got like five boxes they're trying to carry, you say, do you want a hand, mate? They go, no, I'm right. You know, like it's just, like the easiest thing in the world is to just take one of the boxes off you. You know, you might now not trip. But the whole purpose of this journey that you're undertaking may in fact have a higher chance of success than it otherwise would have, you know, that's in that way.
Yeah.
And so the fundamental premise of a second set of eyes would be what for you in say writing the book, but also in the sort of the core meaning behind it?
Well, the real premise is that, again, coaching is sitting right in front of us. It's actually what we're selling as coaches to our players or as CEOs to, you know, further down the organization, that by virtue of believing that human beings can't reach their potential without a coach or a second set of eyes, or an athlete can't reach their potential, or a team can't reach their potential, and that it is coaching that is the process that helps them do that, you're advocating for a second set of eyes. And it's one of the great ironies of maybe our lifetime that we don't then apply that rationale to ourselves. And so my point is, you cannot make the argument to your team that they can't reach their potential, or your athletes that they can't reach their potential, if you then say, but I can on my own. That just doesn't stack up. And
that's beautifully simple. Again, That's a wonderful way of saying it.
We're advocating for the power of coaching, but that means that everyone must take that advice. And the great thing is there are a lot of great people, and like Craigie is one that I've learned an awful lot about this world from, around, you know, people with real coaching experience who are wanting to help coaches and leaders to realize their potential.
There's just something beautifully simple. And I think it is probably the irony of our expertise a little bit as well, isn't it? That, you know, we think of ourselves as being experts at this thing. So somehow that means we don't need it in that way. And there could be a little bit of ego and a little bit of all of that. And Craigie talks about in the podcast, he talks about the performance ego. Yes, coaches need to be really high on performance ego, but he also talks about the idea of a quiet ego. What do I need to learn? How do I need to grow? The more and more I've thought about leadership over the years is leadership is really very situational. What the moment and the situation expects of you. And if you find yourself in anything other than something you've experienced before, which is going to happen all the time, well, you know, you're going to need people to help you see things that perhaps you won't naturally see in your own, through your own set of eyes in that way. You know, your blind spots, all of the things which we know get in the road of good outcomes.
Yeah. From a sporting perspective as well, I think, and you can talk to this better than most perhaps, is it's still a relatively new phenomenon, the size of the organisations that we have. Like, you know, when I was coming through, it was only, you know, the early 2000s, but footy teams were a senior coach and an assistant coach. Most of the teams I was on maybe had a part-time doctor. So there still wasn't like full-time doctors. You had a fitness coach, you know, they were kind of coming through, your Darren Burgesses and the like, you know, kind of early 2000s, right? So it's still a relatively new phenomenon that we've now gone to coaching panels the size of footy teams. You know, there's almost one assistant coach per player on the field and a high performance department and an analytics department, and you need a general manager of footy now, and you've got a women's team. And so you've gone to this, in a relatively short space of time, a completely new model of leading just a footy team. And we're still relatively small in footy compared to soccer and NFL and other sports. But again, it just further facilitates this idea around your job being more organizational dynamics and people in departments, and a third nutritionist and their needs and wants in their career might take up an hour of your day. And those things just 15-20 years ago didn't even exist. And so the size of the organization's growing also creates human complexity. And that's really, I think, what a second set of eyes can help with the most. It's not the expertise. It's not, you know, it's not the X's and O's. If you don't have that nailed, and I think you and Michael Voss talked about this, if you get to that level and you don't have that down, you're going to struggle anyway. But the amount of things that are going to occur on a day-to-day basis in the environment that will ultimately impact your player's ability to go and carry out that game plan, there's too many events for the amount of hours that you have. And so in particular, I think that's why we really need to think about this second set of eyes idea, is because the complexity has just taken off and we've just kind of avoided it and hoped that it would go away. But, you know, if you're leading a multi-million dollar organization with, you know, 5 to 7 departments, you're going to want to, you know, take pause around the human beings in the building and their impact on everything that goes on.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. Yeah, and going back to Michael Voss at Carlton, just observing a team training session, was we observed, I think it was 17 or 18 teams were out on the field at any one time. So there was one team, footy team, but there was forwards, mids, backs, development coaches, conditioning coaches, a bit of media, there was 17, which all have in their own way, someone who's sort of leading it, someone, you know, it, in many cases very flat, but you're dealing, say, the conditioning medical area is a highly complex sort of area. And I often differentiate between complicated issues and complex issues. I think a complicated issue is normally system-based. We can find a solution. We can work our way through it. And we certainly have to dig deep into all of that. But that's normally a question of expertise and understanding and insights and those types of things. Whereas a complex issue is one mostly around dynamic. And that's why this idea of leadership being situational is that you have to understand the dynamic. And if the dynamic isn't something that is serving the group, the team, the organisation well, particularly as they have grown, that responsibility sits with our leader at some point. And the leader only ever brings one set of eyes, one set of ears, and one imagination into that scenario. So unless that person's got the wisdom of whoever, whichever God, religious figure, or we want to actually draw upon at this particular point, it just simply can't work. And yes, you need to have that person being the best they can be. And the interesting thing in regard to that is that as it's with the complexity and with the extra people, all it's done is added to the busyness, which is then the very reason why people say, well, I haven't got time to spend time with someone who's a second set of eyes. I haven't got time to spend someone who's a coach. I go, well, it just seems to me you might be making the right trade-offs, because you're probably trading off almost the thing which should be priority 1, 2, or 3 for priority 20, 21, 22. That's what it's telling me, because 20, 21, and 22 are probably the noisiest ones. They're probably buzzing on your wrist or buzzing in your pocket as you speak now, rather than spending 2 hours with a coach or an hour with you and a pencil doing some journaling to make sense of the crazy complexity of your world.
It's a new workflow. And I think by acknowledging that it's a new workflow, you acknowledge that the old workflow was fit for purpose back then, but the world has changed. And, you know, I don't think, and again, one of the reasons the examples in Second Set of Eyes are the examples is because, you know, if you had told me that Pep Guardiola and Emma Hayes, the US women's national team coach, and Eddie Jones and Michael Voss, you know, believed in this pen and that they were selling this pen, people would rush out to the supermarket to buy this pen. But the second that you say that they believe in coaching and a new workflow and going and having a second set of eyes and doing the pre-work that you're talking about and changing their workflow so they've got time, but they can also get home and see the kids. The second that you say that it's that, people are like, no, it's not for me. I'm fine.
Yeah.
And so again, you're starting to see in a competitive landscape, a lot of very forward-thinking coaches going this way. And so I think more people need to be taking this seriously because, again, it is a competitive landscape, and that's part of how they're getting ahead, is that they have this new workflow that's fit for purpose now.
Is it the next important thing? With all the trends, all the changes, all the things which has led to the, you know, we're trying to grow our clubs, make our clubs better, make our organisations better, doing all these different things. Is it the next most important thing? Is there anything more important than your leaders being in the best place they possibly can in order to lead?
I would position leadership as the most important skill of this century. I think it's all we've been talking about in my side of the world. It's all we've been talking about.
The whole world, mate. The whole world.
So... you know, in one sense, but I think, again, as these leadership challenges continue to rear their head, I think we need to really reckon with the fact that there is nothing more important than the leadership element. And potentially with technological advances, which is the other thing that people say hold up as the next most important thing, they're actually going to take away a lot of the things that are more that process and systems thing that can be fixed over there anyway. So more time needs to be spent on the human and leadership elements anyway. So for human beings, I think it's undoubted that leadership and teamwork is the thing of this century, not just in vogue at the moment for this kind of, you know, 18 months or whatever it is.
Yeah. And the danger is that kind of work has always been hard. The getting in close and trying to work out what tensions we have inside groups, what conflicts we have inside teams, how do we come up with something which brings some form of resolution to the unresolvable, you know, that's the hard work of leadership and always has been. There's always been a comfortable element of leadership, which is the X's and O's, whiteboards, you know, putting together org charts and all this sort of stuff. Neil Baum is a wonderful fellow. He says, he calls it the looks good form. Yeah, it looks good. You know, doesn't work, but it looks good, you know, that sort of idea, you know, because that person won't work with that person, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, I remember he'd come in and I go, how's the team? He goes, it looks good. Okay, I don't know if we can win, but it looks good, you know, because it's got blokes in the right spots, you know, or whatever it might be. But if you're not coming to terms with, and probably the gift of a fellow like him was that he was wonderful in that stuff, you know. You watch a game with him, someone makes a mistake and everyone, you know, you throw your head back and you do whatever you do in response to that. He just leaned over and he goes, "I don't think he did it deliberately." He'd say, "I don't think he did it deliberately." Just this beautiful, understated sort of way. You know, let's not go to a place of blame here. And I love your work and we've had a good chat. We've been going a little bit of time now. I often like to just finish with, you know, and I'll put you on the spot a little bit, a little question you might have for me. You know, I always, as you said, been on your podcast a couple of times. There's a little question come to mind you might have for me is just to finish off our conversation.
Yeah, well, I was interested in your commentary on leadership.
Yeah.
You know, and the way that I framed it was around the understanding of the team, as opposed to, you know, we've done a lot on the qualities of leaders and, you know, we've had the "are they born, created" conversation, and we've, you know, we seem to have kind of done the leader bit. But what strikes me about, you know, again, where maybe people see misalignments is a lack of understanding of what the team needs at this time. And I think we've seen that in recent elections in particular, is like people are shocked at the outcomes rather than kind of listening to, like deep listening to the people that are the team. And so, yeah, my question to you is, do we have it around the right way? Should we be doing more listening to the team and what they need? Or should we be spending more time on trying to figure out what great leadership looks like?
Well, I think great leadership looks like insight and understanding as to what the team needs to be the best it can be. And there's judgment in that. And so the basis of judgment is what are you basing your insights on? And, you know, I'm writing this book at the moment, "No One Tells a CEO Their Baby's Ugly" is the name of my book, because I found it really difficult for people to give me the insights that I needed, in fact, to make the decisions, because people weren't, I wasn't making myself available to those insights. And that might have been partly, you know, there's obviously position embedded in that. You're the CEO, so there is that layer to it. But you're also, one of the things we always have to recognize is that those who are members of your team, say as a CEO, have a very strong natural bias towards their own areas as well. You know, that if is it a financial problem, a marketing problem, a communication problem, whatever it might be. And generally when people talk about, say, a lack of clarity or a lack of communication, for me, I think of both of those things as outcomes. How do we actually create conditions whereby we at least give good, decent communication, decent clarity a chance, you know, of happening? And I think of culture as an outcome. I think of team as an outcome. You know, the fact that we're all together, you know, in the same room doesn't make us a team unless we actually start to establish some team-based behaviours. I don't teach anything I haven't fucked up, and I did fuck that up a few times. So that's one of the thoughts I have, is that you basically, as leader, you're closing out the conversation rather than creating the space for it, but also recognising that you, at some point, it needs to land somewhere. And to be okay that it's not going to land in a perfect place, but it's going to be, you know, and you and I love Rick Rubin's work, and he talks about agreement rather than, he talks about alignment and not agreement as an example. Well, can we actually align on this? Yeah, we can. And we can align on that knowing there's a very good chance it could be wrong. That's trust, because we're dealing with imperfect information here. If there's perfect information, we don't even need to be in this room. Because it's just going to make it, yeah. A machine can make that decision. So it's creating conditions where we're able to dance in that space. Whereas I grew up, and you grew up as leaders, as people who ride in their white horses, as having all the answers. So coming to a room now and saying, "Look, obviously I've got thoughts on this, I've got ideas on this, but my goal is to draw forward the collective imagination of the people in this room." And unless you're actually prepared to bring your imagination into this room and have an idea, have a thought, you should not be in this room. It's a basis by which you're in the room, is to have a thought, even if your thought makes a 2% contribution to this. And that takes work and that takes effort, and they're really, everyone in that room at that moment is wishing they weren't in that room. Yeah, they'd much happier answering their emails. So that tells you leadership's pretty challenging. Coaching's hard. And the idea of the second set of eyes is to help those people, or that person in particular, the leader in that environment, to be okay with operating and dancing in that little space there, because that's actually what you're being paid for. And I find it really challenging is that that's the nuance of leadership, but it's rarely judged in that way. It's judged in a very binary way, but really the judgment is you've got to be close to that nuance to have the insight and understanding. It's like people will say, you know, how do you think the Tigers are going at the moment? You know, they've had a lot of change. I have no idea because I haven't been in those rooms. No idea. And so I just get all I'm doing is reducing myself to outcomes. That's the only thing, or sound bites, you know, or press conferences, or because that's what you get to see.
Yeah.
Unless you're actually in those rooms, you can't judge it.
Agree.
That's fair.
Wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Cool. All right, mate. Well, I know you've got a little 3-year-old's going to run in a minute, and thanks very much for doing it. Doing this, I could talk to you all day, and I've loved the opportunity of being on your podcast. I'm really wrapped it up, and I would have reciprocated. So, thanks very much, Cody, for coming on board and being in the arena with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, mate. It's an honour.
Cheers. Thank you.